Hello and welcome back to Off the Page, where your hosts Helen Holgate and
Sandra Burney
uncover excerpts from the written word of women. In this year of the women, we are proud to bring you our selection of theme-based writing. And don't forget, if you do have a favourite nugget you would like to share with us, you can contact us here on Cambridge 105 Radio. So, Sandra, would you like to enlighten us what our theme is today?
Thank you, Helen. Well, in this programme, we've chosen some very interesting and varied writing with different perspectives on death. Not necessarily the most cheerful of topics, but one that has really inspired writers and gives them lots to think about. Death, as someone, probably Johnson, said, is an inevitable fact of life, death and taxes. Mm-hmm. And so although it might be hard for us to talk about, authors have been writing about it since the first pen was put to paper. So today's show will be looking at three different female authors and how they use the subject of death to explore those different themes.
Our first author that we're going to look at today is Kate Chopin. She was a writer who was all but lost to the literary canon until her re-emergence and reclassification as a writer of importance starting in the 1980s. So although her works were written and published at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, one of the really interesting things is you will find her writing is so fresh and edgy. Kate Chopin has a modest canon of work, with her most well-known piece being The Awakening. Many of her short stories also deal with similar themes of feminism, feminine strength and candour. She often dares to suggest that there is more to a woman than the role of a wife and mother. In The Story of an Hour, we meet Mrs. Mallard as she has just been told of her husband's death. It would be fair to assume that a story about loss and grief will be very, very sad and dramatic, but the reader may well be in for a surprise. So, Sandra, I'll let you read that, The Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin, written in 1894.
Knowing that Mrs. Mallard was afflicted with a heart trouble, great care was taken to break to her as gently as possible the news of her husband's death. It was her sister Josephine who told her, in broken sentences, veiled hints that revealed in half-concealing. Her husband's friend Richard was there too, near her. It was he who had been in the newspaper office when intelligence of the railroad disaster was received, with Brently Mallard's name leading the list of killed. He had only taken the time to assure himself of its truth by a second telegram, and had hastened to forestall any less careful, less tender friend in bearing the sad message. She did not hear the story, as many women have heard the same, with a paralysed inability to accept its significance. She wept at once with sudden, wild abandonment in her sister's arms. When the storm of grief had spent itself, she went away to her room alone. She would have no one follow her. There stood, facing the open window, a comfortable, roomy armchair. Into this she sank, pressed down by a physical exhaustion that haunted her body and seemed to reach into her soul. She could see the open square before her house, the tops of trees that were all aquiver with the new spring life. The delicious breath of rain was in the air. In the street below, a peddler was crying his wares. The notes of a distant song which someone was singing reached her faintly, and countless sparrows were twittering in the eaves. There were patches of blue sky showing here and there through the clouds that had met and piled one above the other in the west, facing her window. She sat with her head thrown back upon the cushion of the chair, quite motionless, except when a sob came up into her throat and shook her, as a child who has cried itself to sleep continues to sob in its dreams. She was young, with a fair, calm face, whose lines bespoke repression and even a certain strength. But now there was a dull stare in her eyes, whose gaze was fixed away off yonder on one of those patches of blue sky. It was not a glance of reflection, but rather indicated a suspension of intelligent thought. There was something coming to her, and she was waiting for it fearfully. What was it? She did not know. It was too subtle and elusive to name, but she felt it, creeping out of the sky, reaching toward her through the sounds, the scents, the colour that filled the air. Now, her bosom rose and fell tumultuously. She was beginning to recognise this thing that was approaching to possess her, and she was striving to beat it back with her will, as powerless as her two white slender hands would have been. When she abandoned herself, a little whispered word escaped her slightly parted lips. She said it over and over, under her breath. Free. 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 The vacant stare and the look of terror that had followed it went from her eyes. They stayed keen and bright. Her pulses beat fast, and the coursing blood warmed and relaxed every inch of her body. She did not stop to ask if it were or were not a monstrous joy that held her. A clear and exalted perception enabled her to dismiss the suggestion as trivial. She knew that she would weep again when she saw the kind, tender hands folded in death, the face that had never looked save with love upon her, fixed and grey and dead. But she saw beyond that bitter moment a long procession of years to come that would belong to her absolutely, and she opened and spread her arms out to them in welcome. There would be no one to live for during those coming years. She would live for herself. There would be no powerful will bending hers in that blind persistence with which men and women believe they have a right to impose a private will upon a fellow creature. A kind intention, or a cruel intention, made the act seem no less a crime as she looked upon it in that brief moment of illumination. And yet, she had loved him. Sometimes. Often she had not. What did it matter? What could love, the unsolved mystery, count for in the face of this possession of self-assertion which she suddenly recognised as the strongest impulse of her being? Free. Body and soul free, she kept whispering. Josephine was kneeling before the closed door with her lips to the keyhole, imploring for admission. Louise, open the door, I beg. Open the door, you will make yourself ill. What are you doing, Louise? For heaven's sake, open the door. Go away. I'm not making myself ill. No, she was drinking in a very elixir of life through that open window. Her fancy was running riot along those days ahead of her, spring days and summer days and all sorts of days that would be her own. She breathed a quick prayer that life might be long. It was only yesterday she had thought with a shudder that life might be long. She arose at length and opened the door to her sister's importunities. There was a feverish triumph in her eyes, and she carried herself unwittingly like a goddess of victory. She clasped her sister's waist, and together they descended the stairs. Richard stood waiting for them at the bottom. Someone was opening the front door with a latchkey. It was Brently Mallard who entered, a little travel-stained, composedly carrying his gripsack and umbrella. He had been far from the scene of the accident and did not even know there had been one. He stood amazed at Josephine's piercing cry, at Richard's quick motion to screen him from the view of his wife. When the doctors came, they said she had died of heart disease, of the joy that kills.
Thank you, Sandra.
Oh.
Well, it may only be 1,000 words long, but it shows that a writer doesn't need to be wordy or long to get across important points and ideas. I mean, Chopin uses death to show how the trappings of marriage and women's lack of choices in society, and to explore the idea of a woman desiring to be her own person. Although it's funny because Chopin also plays a bit with the reader by never giving us her character's actual name. So she's always trapped in her marriage, and her identity is forever that of Mrs. Mallard, the wife who was almost free.
I know, and she's free for such a short time.
Blink of freedom.
One female poet who's particularly well known for her writings on death is Christina Rossetti. So she was born in 1830 and died in 1894 in England. And she wrote a variety of romantic and devotional children's poems. She is most famous for writing Goblin Market and Remember. And Rossetti was educated at home by her mother and father, who had her study religious works, classics, fairy tales and novels. In the 1840s, her family faced severe financial difficulties due to the deterioration of her father's physical and mental health. Though he lived another 11 years, he suffered from depression, was never physically well again. Rossetti's mother began teaching to keep the family out of poverty. When she was 14, Rossetti suffered a nervous breakdown and left school. Bouts of depression and related illness followed, and during this period, she, her mother and her sister became deeply interested in the Anglo-Catholic movement that developed in the Church of England. Religious devotion came to play a major role in Rossetti's life. By her 16th birthday, Christina, who was regarded as the poet in the family, had written more than 50 poems. So, quite prolific. Her early pieces often featuring meditations on death and loss in the Romantic tradition. We're going to hear three of her poems now that all have the subject matter of death and yet still offer us a sense of reassurance and calm. So, this is Remember, read by Helen.
Remember me when I am gone away, gone far away into the silent land. When you can no more hold me by the hand, nor I half turn to go, yet turning stay. Remember me when no more day by day you tell me of our future that you planned. Only remember me, you understand, it will be too late to counsel then or pray. Yet if you should forget me for a while, and afterward remember, do not grieve. For if the darkness and corruption leave a vestige of the thought that once I had, better by far you should forget and smile than you should remember and be sad. Sandra will now read After Death, written by Christina in 1862.
The curtains were half drawn. The floor was swept and strewn with rushes, rosemary and may lay thick upon the bed on which I lay, where through the lattice ivy shadows crept. He leaned above me, thinking that I slept and could not hear him, but I heard him say, "Poor child, poor child." And as he turned away came a deep silence, and I knew he wept. He did not touch the shroud, or raise the fold that hid my face, or take my hand in his, or ruffle the smooth pillows for my head. He did not love me living, but once dead, he pitied me. And very sweet it is to know he still is warm, though I am cold. And now Helen will read When I Am Dead, which is written in 1848, but it wasn't actually published until 1862.
Thank you. When I am dead, my dearest, sing no sad songs for me. Plant thou no roses at my head, nor shady cypress tree. Be the green grass above me, with showers and dewdrops wet. And if thou wilt remember, and if thou wilt forget, I shall see not the shadows, I shall feel not the rain, I shall not hear the nightingale sing on as if in pain. And dreaming through the twilight that doth not rise nor set, happily I may remember, and happily may forget.
So, it's not just the classical authors that find themselves writing on death and dying. Hannah Pearl is a new author who won the recent Heatseeker short story competition. This competition threw its doors open to all budding authors, challenging them to write a 2,500-word story that would grab the minds and hearts of the judges. The competition had nearly 600 entries, with a long list of 19. And The Last Good Day looks at death from the point of view not of the person dying, but of her best friend. It's a story as much about the bond of friendship as it is about a person's last day. Helen will read an abridged version of Hannah's story. The Last Good Day.
Knock, knock. I'm hiding under the duvet. Dave lifted the covers and climbed underneath. I brought you tea. I took the mug he offered. Using our heads as tent poles to create a space, we sat side by side on our bed. I don't think I can do this. She's counting on you, Helen. We scrabbled to get dressed. The shifts changed at 8 a.m, and if we could get there in time, we'd be able to sneak her out unnoticed. I brought you a wig. If they can't handle a bald chick in a wheelchair, then that's their problem. Belle swept the blonde curls out of my hand and onto the floor, where they resembled a squished poodle. Come on, Helen. I need to get out for a bit. I miss the sunshine. I want to see the sky again. The sea. I lifted her from the bed into the chair. She was a lot lighter than the last time she asked me to piggyback her home. We'd been returning from our university bar and our high heels had rubbed. Now, though, the ovarian cancer had almost completely extinguished the spark from the most exciting person I had ever met. It was all the more reason to try and give her the most wonderful day that she could manage. I peeked around the door into the hall, but no one seemed to be watching what we were doing. Belle quickly began to remove the needle from the crook of her arm, wincing as she did. I tried to stop her, but she just stared at me. Don't worry so much. Hell's bells are overdue an adventure. Her play on our teenage nickname, well deserved as it had been, was enough to break through my fog and get us moving again. Taking the blue cotton throw from her bed, I wrapped it around her and tucked it under her bony legs. I glanced hurriedly around the ward, but there were no staff in sight. They're in the office talking about who woke up crying in the night and needed more medication, and who won't make it until the morning. Belle, stop talking like that. Now come on. Good old dependable Helen. That was me. I'd been right behind her when she had ordered our first drinks in a pub when we were 16. I had held her handbag after she had drunk one too many Bacardi Breezers and had to ring her dad to pick us up. She'd been grounded for a fortnight. I hadn't. My parents knew that I wouldn't get into any trouble if Belle wasn't around. It had been the most boring 2 weeks of my life, and I had missed her every second. We were almost at the door of the ward when a voice rang out behind us. Where are you off to? Oh, they've asked me to go for a scan, Belle lied smoothly. The nurse looked at us both, gave a small smile and walked back towards the staff room. Do you think they believed us? I asked. Do you want to hang around and risk finding out? Belle made a good point. I followed her directions and in no time we made it through the myriad of corridors and crowds and out of the hospital. I'm parked at the top of the multi-storey. Belle took a moment to catch her breath, trying to hide the laboured movement of her chest underneath the blanket. But I knew. Now, where to? Belle sat quietly for a moment. Seaside might not be a great idea, she said quietly. Too much traffic. I knew that what she really meant was that she didn't feel well enough to travel so far, but neither of us wanted to acknowledge that. Bar? Too loud to talk, she answered. Pub? I always preferred bars myself, she smiled. I reached behind her to find the map book that Dave always insisted I carry in the car. Let's look for some inspiration. And there, tucked between the pages, was a note. Hell's Bells Super Special Picnic. A space has been reserved for your party next to the lake. Dave. He knew that Belle loved being by the water. He must have known that she couldn't make it to the beach. Not this time. So we drove, and I sang along to the radio as we had on all the adventures we'd had before in this car. Belle sat back and closed her eyes, smiling but not joining in. When we reached the park, she waited in the car until I got her wheelchair from the boot. I wheeled her away from the cafe and the crowds of children outside, begging their parents for ice cream. Following the path over the bridge, we came to a picnic bench by the side of the water. On top sat a wicker basket. There was no note this time, but the bottle of Bacardi Breezer sticking out in Dave's old blue coat next to it let me know it was for us. I wrapped the jacket around Belle's shoulders.
Inside the basket were treats that Belle and I had enjoyed in our travels. Grapes, just like the last time she had organised for us to spend the summer on a vineyard in Italy. A baguette, not quite as good as the still warm ones we'd picked up from the local boulangerie in Paris, but good enough with a chunk of Belle's favourite camembert. There was even a packet of penguin biscuits and a thermos. It took a moment for my brain to understand, but finally it clicked. They were the poor man's imitation of the Tim Tams that we'd brought Dave back after Belle had organised our trip to Australia. It had been my 21st birthday present, to visit the neighbours' set and meet some of my heroes. Belle didn't share my enjoyment of the programme, but she loved me enough to go with only the minimum of asking if I was serious. Now I poured Belle a cup of tea, added a few of the sugar sachets Dave had thoughtfully tucked underneath to give her a little more energy, and lifted the cup to her lips so that she could sip it. If I'd had a bucket list, I think that having a proper cup of tea with my best mate would have been on there. Not bungee jumping naked. Again? She laughed. I never needed the motivation of trying to finish a list before I go. If I wanted to do something, then I did it. I remember. She stared deep into her mug, as if the wisdom she sought was buried in there. Perhaps it was. There must be a reason why we all head straight for a cuppa when something serious arises. Did you ever regret spending time with me? I reached across and grasped her hand. It was cold and the skin dry like an old lady's. Never, I assured her. You've been making my life better since you chased Stephen Cooper away in primary school. Do you remember? We couldn't have been more than six. He'd been teasing me and pushing me over for weeks. All the teachers would say was, "It's because he likes you." Funny way to show it. I was so scared, and you were the only person who understood and actually helped me. No, I wouldn't change a thing. Except that I'd have given anything to make her well again, because the unspoken question was, how was I going to cope without her in the future? That was such a vast unknown that I pushed the thoughts away, unable to begin to grasp what a world without Belle might feel like. You'd be married with four children by now if it weren't for me. You and Dave would work in 9-to-5 jobs with no creativity and fall asleep on the sofa every evening next to a farting dog. I am married, I reminded her. It had been the one concession that she had allowed me to make, bringing our wedding forward so to ensure that she was well enough to enjoy it. And as for the babies... Well, I know it's traditional to wait until you pass the 12-week mark, but I never did hide anything from you. I took the test yesterday. You'll be a great mum. You kept me safe all these years. I'm only sorry that I won't be here to see it. Will you name the baby after me? Not if it's a boy. I want to avoid gender stereotyping, but that might be pushing it. Besides, I think Dave would have a heart attack if our daughter got up to half the things we used to. It was worth it, though. Totally. You encouraged me to apply to art school. You pushed me not to be scared, but to make the most of every opportunity. I wouldn't be the person I am without you. Time for one last adventure. What did you have in mind? I have to warn you, if we get arrested, I'm totally dobbing you in. I'm not having my baby in prison. Belle laughed again. And just for a moment, I saw her as the 16-year-old girl who had encouraged me to go skinny dipping with her in that very lake. She'd had a plan back then too. She'd texted Dave without my knowing. I'd almost died from embarrassment when I got out to find him standing there. But sure enough, he'd asked me out the next day, and we'd been together ever since. One of the doctors has bad breath. Break into his car and leave some mouthwash on the seat. No, too mean. I know. Do you still have that wig? Let's go to that posh coffee shop where the waiters are really snotty. I'll pretend to see a mouse, and when I jump up, my wig can fall off. I want to see if I can make that grumpy manager scream. I kissed her cheek. I'll carry the basket to the car and come back for you. I'm not moving. There was a tear on her cheek when I returned from the car. She brushed it away, and when I tried to ask if she wanted to talk, she refused. Cry tomorrow. Today is for celebrating being together. You've been the sister I never had but always wanted. She stared out of the window after that. Admitting her feelings didn't come easily, Belle had always preferred to show how she felt. She didn't look back until I told her about my most recent midwife visit. I hadn't screwed the lid on my urine sample properly, and the bus driver hadn't been too impressed when I'd tried to pay with soggy coins. She gave a small laugh, but not the hearty one I'd heard so often over the years. I knew that she was paying now for our trip. When we got back to the hospital, she didn't make any comments when it took me 3 attempts to park. I switched off the ignition and reached across for her hand. I gave it a small squeeze and she squeezed back, though I could see a flicker of pain across her brow. I lifted her into her chair as gently as I could and began to wheel her back through the maze of corridors to her room. Love you, Belle. Love you too, Hells. Thank you for the adventure. I needed one last good day with you. It doesn't have to be the last time, I told her. We got away with it, I think. Maybe you can think of somewhere you fancy going next week. She smiled and waved slowly as I left the room. It was too much for her, though, and by the time I got back, she was gone. Helen, do you want your black dress ironing for the funeral? Thanks, love, but Belle would have hated everyone looking so sombre. I'm going in the red skirt that she was always borrowing. Besides, I can't fit in the dress any more. He came and sat next to me on the bed. Are you okay? I shook my head. But I have you, so one day I'm going to be fine again. You know, I never figured out how we managed to get out of the ward without the doctor stopping us, given how ill she was. That's why they let her out. I phoned them just after you left and warned them. You both needed the chance to say goodbye. The doctors knew that all they could do by then was manage her pain, so if she felt well enough to go, they were happy. I just smoothed the path. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a handful of pellets. Passing them to me, he kissed my cheek and stood up. I looked at them. Are we taking stink bombs to her funeral? Nope. We're making a stop before we go. I popped into that cafe for a sandwich yesterday and saw them kicking a mum out because they said her kid was too loud. I'm going to open the door and you're going to lob those in. He winked. And somewhere I knew that Belle was smiling down on us.
Oh. Thank you, Helen. A very touching story indeed. And it's just about those moments of absolute pleasure.
Yes.
And
the small moments in life that...
I think that's what we don't take any notice of, or not enough notice of, are those small moments. Just make them a small moment. It doesn't have to be a great big deal, does it?
Very precious.
Well, that's all for this edition of Off the Page with
Helen Holgate
and Sandra Burney on Cambridge 105 Radio. Do get in touch if there's something you'd like us to read. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.